This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 10th of January 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to edition 340 of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and Robert Bound.
On the show today, we'll be taking a global trip through some of the best music that the world has to offer with DJ, record label boss, and all-round champion of sounds unusual and unsung, Giles Peterson, who'll be joining us a little later.
We'll also be learning how to put a man into space, a Welsh man wearing Welshy things. Designer Heffin Jones will be here to tell us all about his cosmic colliery.
And we'll be looking at some of the world's best talents in filmmaking as Philip Ilson, director of the London Short Film Festival, drops in.
That's all to come, plus Monocle's Tom Edwards will be here with the news. Look ahead, I'm going to enjoy some well-selected music, of course, too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
So here we are, Andrew. 2016, any New Year's resolutions that you've already broken? Are you back with a bang or a whimper?
I think I broke them. I had chips at lunchtime. I don't think they're allowed.
I thought I saw you down at the casino on a Sunday. but it's a good thing. I feel braced for 2016 impact. I feel like I had a good break and I've hit the ground running.
Everyone went very quiet over the Christmas New Year. I think everyone was a bit hibernating and everyone seems to be back on the little hamster wheel, ready to start trotting.
Yeah. And what are you feeding them to keep them going?
Just nuts. Just nuts. That's all they're getting this year. the odd sunflower seed, if they're well behaved.
You're meant to throw the nuts in the hamster wheel to keep them going. You can't just waggle them out from outside.
Exactly.
anyway, before this turns ridiculous and smutty, should we turn to the very serious business of news?
Who's that moving at the speed of light? Darting around the globe with his golden cape of flutter, waggling his chunky glasses, and giving us a knowing wink as he passes. His cuddly beauty silhouetted against the stars. Who could have such a wise yet pretty face? Or such a wiggly bottom? Could it be? Oh yes, it's Monocle's very own Clark Kent, our intrepid reporter and all-round lifesaver. And look, he's coming into land. Please welcome the one and only Super Tedwards, the news bear who likes his stories served with ice cream, please. We love you, Super Tedwards.
Wow.
Drink it in, people. New year, same old theme tune. Pretty good. I want to know if my wiggly bottom has a sound effect. What's the sound effect that goes with Andrew waggling his nuts outside a hamster's cage? Just a thought. Something to start the year.
I'm sure by the end of the programme someone will have emailed in with some suggestions for sound effects. Maybe a YouTube video.
Probably come up with something. As long as that doesn't go blah, 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 like that other one as well. No. We'll see what happens.
Oh, dear. Yeah, but your bum never seen the same place twice.
No, very far, very swift.
Swift.
Very swift.
Nice. Welcome to the new year, Tom. At least a Monocle on Monocle Week in Monocle Weekly.
Parlance, exactly. Yeah. You're both looking...
Worn
you're
out both looking.
I was going to say, you're both looking very well.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Let's get this started.
Yeah, well, let's motor through a few of these. A little clue there.
There we go.
We're going to Detroit from tomorrow, kicking things off with the
convention.
No, it's not hamsters. It's automobiles in the spotlight, Rob.
Okay.
Monocle 24 is going to be checking in at the Detroit Auto Show.
Who's Monocle's Clarkson?
Could there be one? Our good friend, your friend and mine, Ed Stocker, I believe, is going to be there.
And New York bureau chief.
And so he has made the hop up to Detroit.
Does he have a driving license?
I don't know. Actually.
I hope he does.
But he'll be reporting from there. I know, Andrew, you can't wait to find out what's going to be North America's truck of the year.
That's probably more fun than the regular car sections.
Hey, listen.
Andrew just loves any pickup of the year.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's good. I like it. I'm actually a bit of a secret petrolhead. I think we might have talked about that before. Yes. So I would be genuinely.
I would be very interested in that.
Rob Bound loves Clarkson in reality.
I don't love Clarkson in reality.
I don't mean personally, but you like his oeuvre.
I think, well.
I think we shouldn't get into
this. This is getting bad. It's the first. My first.
Okay, let's raise levels, but we'll stay stateside. State of the Union address on Tuesday. That time of year, it's rolled around again, and of course, it's the final annual address from Barack Obama, delivered as ever to the joint session of Congress in Washington on Tuesday night. Okay, yeah, he'll be making a few remarks about what he plans in the final year. But I think it'd be more interesting to see what's the tone of it. You know, only a year to go. It's hard almost to believe we're almost at the end of the Obama era. One imagines he's been so emotional about a lot of things. A lot of people have been a little disappointed about what he's got done, but a lot of that's not really been his fault. I think his tone will be intriguing to see.
But I think with the interesting things he's said about gun control lately, I get the feeling at least he's not kind of trying to be just sitting out his months as his presidency ends. He seems to think, okay, I can risk a few things here and let's see what else we can get done.
Yeah.
And I think he might come out fighting.
Well, it's interesting. I think that was a really extraordinary press conference, whenever that was, last week. You know, real conviction. I mean, some of his critics accused him of being manipulative and saying he's playing to the gallery of, you know, people on what is, you know, the left in the States with that emotional display. But I think, yeah, I agree. It could be interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things. You don't want him to feel like a crumpled man, you know, a beaten man, kind of going, well, these were my last years, and I might have one last.
Well, people have suggested that he's been a bit of a lame duck, you know, for large chunks, particularly the second term, because of the domestic balance of politics on Capitol Hill. But interesting to watch. Shall we head from the sublime to the ridiculous now?
Yes, please.
I'm pretty sure we followed this last year, the World Scotch Pie Championships. Scotch Pie. It's rolled around again, and on Wednesday, you remember the event. The tagline is, "Say aye to a pie." Do you not remember that?
I don't even know. Is this something to do with Burns?
No, it's a Scotch Pie. So, well, a variety of different pies, pastries, sausage rolls, bridies. No, me neither. Okay. And savouries have been entered into the competition. Basically, it's some kind of meat encased in pastry.
Mystery meat. Everyone loves that.
Mystery meat.
Mystery meat.
More often than not, beef these days. Right. But formerly other.
And
other
what's
sorts.
The format of the competition?
I think it's just a simple taste test.
Oh, okay.
Oh, it's not a
which you like best.
It's
take
not an
your
eating
choice.
Competition. Okay, right.
Oh, no, it's not one of those.
You don't have to roll it down a street or like drop it from a high building.
Set it on fire and throw it out of a window or something. No, it's just simply expert panel. They consume different Scotch pies. They name their winner, Andrew, and then the public can head along and you know, sample the wares direct
That's
from
like
the horse's mouth.
It's like a nice, gentle democratic process. I quite like that.
We should encourage it.
Yeah, I like it.
What else is happening? I like to include an animal item. Not encased in pastry, but an actual living animal. On Saturday, I don't know, I think we talked about this last year as well.
Is that a tail sticking out of that gratin?
Excuse me. In Washington, D.C., Bebe is making his first public appearance.
Okay, this is a panda?
We're talking panda diplomacy. I'm sure you'll remember when pictures of Bebe at 4 months old were released to the media back in November.
What are they going to call it when it grows up?
That is such a good joke. That is brilliant.
That's quite good.
Oh God, I can't even believe that. But he lives with his mother, Mei Jiang, and his big sister, Bao Bao, who's two. So he's going to be stepping out. I think he can sort of wander around.
So where is he going to be? Sorry, he's in China.
At National Zoo. No, at National Zoo in Washington.
Oh, sorry, I wasn't listening.
Exactly, so it all ties together. So you've got State of the Union, State of Bebe. It's all happening.
I think it's a beautifully rendered, topped and tailed news look ahead.
Do you want one other thing that's happening next Saturday?
Okay, sorry, yeah.
Well, this ties
not
in,
quite perfect.
Well, I was listening in from the other side of the glass when you were introducing this show. I know you're chatting to Giles Peterson, is that right?
Yeah.
A little later, and I'm sure he'll mention this.
You're going out for a beer later?
We're going for a few drinks. No, cool. It's his worldwide awards. I'm sure, as I said, it will be topic for discussion. But that's happening here in London next weekend. So I thought I'd mention it as well, just to preempt Giles a little bit.
You've just sold my next, the opening interview of the show, I think.
There you go.
Thank you very much, Tom.
It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. here at Monocle, we like to take a global perspective on music and dig out some of the more unusual sounds from across the world for listeners to enjoy. One man who's made discovering the best music from across the world his life's goal is Giles Peterson, the French-born UK-based DJ and record label boss whose tastemaker status for uncovering more unusual global acts has made him an essential voice in world music and a reassuringly familiar one to those who tune in to his weekly show.
Giles has his own festival held every summer in France, the appropriately monikered Worldwide Festival, which Monocle 24 reported from a couple of years back, and he also holds a yearly bash to highlight some of the best musical talents of the past 12 months. The Worldwide Awards, which are taking place at London's COCO on the 16th of January.
A little earlier, Giles dropped by Studio One here at Midori House to tell Rob all about it.
Welcome to the programme, Giles.
Hello, it's good to be here.
Well, thanks for coming in. It's always nice when a renowned DJ and radio presenter comes in and goes, oh, these are nice digs, aren't they? It always makes us...
You can park here.
You can, yeah.
It's not free, bad for the West End.
And free parking. It's a feather in all of our caps.
Excellent.
So we'll kick off with the Worldwide Awards. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's obviously kind of comes presumably from your collated and curated listening over the last year. But how on earth, how do you kind of go about finding out about new stuff? Presumably all your listeners to your shows must want to know this as well.
Yeah.
What's the method by which you kind of get the buzz on new things?
I think the thing is, when you do what I do, which is I work on a few levels when it comes to music, I have my radio show. I do a lot of DJing still as a club DJ. I produce and release records. And so quite a lot of different aspects of the music scene are my day-to-day life, really. And I'm always wondering whether if I just took 6 months off, I'd just fall off completely. You know, it's kind of like being a chef and you just constantly have to be on top of the new ingredients, right, and the new, you know, make sure everything's fresh. And so I've never really been off, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And so I'm just kind of in the game all the time. And I suppose maybe I'm just frightened.
Giles Peterson, but willed on by a sense of,
I've lost
a sense
my edge. It's like the LCD sound system track, but I'm frightened to lose my edge. But no, I mean, the thing is, I luckily for me, as with all these different aspects of the music that I do and play, there's a lot of different music that gets heard, from obscure world music reissues to new music coming out of Cuba or Puerto Rico or Senegal to new electronic bass music from Bristol or Berlin, you know, hip hop and all the jazz. There's so much music. And I just basically spend all week, just my homework is just listening to music, I suppose. And then I just sort of pull in all this music from all these avenues that come my way, whether it's filtered through DJs and producers around the world that we do exchanges with, or whether that's just going to record shops in the old school way. And that's great these days because there's shops popping up all over the place.
That's the strange thing. Also, you know, this show goes out around the world as well, like your shows do, and people will be kind of, presumably your listeners will be heartened at the fact that, you know, maybe the vinyl revolution is slightly overplayed, but that record shops are opening up again. I mean, that must be kind of balm to Giles Peterson's vanity.
Well, it's great, and what people forget about record shops is that, I suppose, it got replaced by the coffee shop in a way in the last sort of 10, 15 years. But it's a community thing, and it's a place where you go and you all bump into DJs and fans of music and discuss music and hear people's opinions. And so in a way, it's something that you can't really do online. I was in Bristol yesterday doing a documentary about the Bristol scene over the last 30 years. And I went to like 5-6 different record shops in Bristol.
Yeah.
It's a small town. It's like not even a million people live there. So I don't think, anyway. So it's great and it's exciting, but that's part of my process. It's like going to those places, listening to shopkeepers, dealers, people behind the counter, looking what's up on the walls, getting music sent to me, and then at the end of the week I'll just kind of pick the best 40-50 songs, and that's what makes it onto my playlist the following day. And in a way, that's kind of like my painting.
That's what we've learned this week, sort of stuff, right?
Yeah, and it's like, that's where I put all my effort. That's my piece of art. You know, I mean, people might say it's just a radio show, just playing a few other people's tunes. But for me, that's like my painting. Those are my colours. That's my piece.
Yeah.
Some weeks it's a bit messy. Some weeks it's smooth.
Week you're figurative. Some week you're abstract.
Yeah, exactly.
It's all right.
Yeah.
How are you feeling? How are you feeling this week?
Jackson Pollock.
Come the new year.
Yeah. Well, I did a lot of Sun Ra last year, so it was very Jackson Pollock last year. But no, it's getting
getting a little bit more Matisse, I'd say.
Very nice. Well, we said at the beginning we're gonna highlight some of the tracks that you're gonna be maybe awarding at the Worldwide Awards on the 16th of January. The first thing we've got is from Ihsan Al-Munzer. What do we know about this track? Because we were talking to Tom, the producer, before you came into the studio, kind of going, do you know what? I'm not quite sure where this comes from, but I love it. So we'll play a little excerpt of it, and then maybe we'll decipher.
Excellent.
What sort of painting this is. Okay, that was a little bit of Jamile by Ihsan Al-Munzer.
Don't ask me more. I don't really know.
All right. Well, let's surmise some stuff. Like, if there was a kind of blaxploitation movie shot in 1970s Baghdad, that might be the soundtrack.
Yeah, I mean, apparently, we're not even sure. I mean, the sleeve of the record I've got, the pictures I've seen, it's a lady on the front cover, and apparently it's from Lebanon. It's from Beirut. What I do know is that it's a record label called Fortuna Records that's based in Tel Aviv, and they have been putting out records, vinyl. They just really search out stuff from Turkey and that particular region, Iran, Iraq, Israel, Greece. And they've really just found these little nugget tracks from back in the day. They remaster them and they put them out on a nice loud 12-inch. And they sound so brilliant in the clubs at the moment. And funnily enough, that song, even though it's, I think, 25, 30 years old, it's just one. It's been my biggest track in 2015, which doesn't sort of say a lot for all the great new music that's been popping up, but it just tells you that in a way the audience is so up for sort of just quirky, interesting, original music, and that it just presses those buttons at this point.
Well, tell us a little bit about that, Charles. About you know, doing your show and doing DJ sets and all the rest of it, and maybe also how you approach running the labels. Mm. The idea of context, you know, the record sleeve, the fact that no one's heard it for 30 years, the fact that it's, you know, the way that it's produced, putting everything to the front of the mix, as it sounds on that. Is it all about what you follow something with, how you package it, even how you introduce it on the record?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think when it comes to world music, I think, first of all, my approach to it all is that, first and foremost, I'm a club DJ, and that kind of, that energy that I get from traveling around the world and doing residencies and playing out, that is a very important ingredient to what I bring into my radio show. That's what makes my radio show, I think, probably different to your standard world music shows or jazz shows or just dance shows. I kind of bring that energy, and that's always been the case for me. Going back to the days when pirate radio had a huge influence on club culture, London club culture was really formed by pirate radio. Any DJ in the club scene back then would have a radio show. You'd break your songs on the radio. And so this is really what's made the UK, I think, always that step ahead of the rest of the world when it's come to developing a club scene and a club culture. So that's still there for me 30 years later. And, you know, music changes and the audiences change. And the other thing for me is that, you know, on one hand, I'll be playing in Ibiza with Carl Cox or Richie Horton, but the next minute I might be playing with Francois Kay in New York, or I'll be playing with Andrew Weatherall in Manchester, or, you know, Joy Orbison or Floating Point. So in a way, the audiences that I'm playing to are quite different in a lot of different places. So I can kind of spot how trends and moods are moving around. And when it comes to kind of electronic, or let's just say exotic tropical music, That goes through its trends. You know, you had your Brazilian moment, then you had your African moment. It was all about Fela, and then it was about Ghana. Mm. Then it went into Senegal, and then Damon had his little thing on it, and then the Africa Express. And then suddenly you're interested in what Quantic's doing and discovering in Colombia. Then you're finding out of the music of Haiti and Guadeloupe. Recently it's been Guadeloupe, Martinique, the Reunion Islands, Sega music, that stuff. You play that out, people are like, they're in. They know that that's kind of like, it's almost like it's got that extra bass line that's just popping in on the bass scene, but for the world music heads. So the Arabic thing, and I think Johnny Green was done really well recently because his new project is like based on Israel and Indian music, and it's got that Arabic flavor, and it's an incredible record, and he's just hit the right mark at this point, because Arabic music with, you know, Omo Solimon and what people like Acid Arab are doing in Paris, squelching Arabic music and giving
squelching, that's the one.
And giving it that little twist is what the kids are into right now.
I hope legions of listeners around the world will be scribbling down all those names and hitting the rewind button as well at the same time. It's about being very nimble then as well, isn't it? You know what I mean? I mean, there is, being a tastemaker, you have to be... Is there a pressure to be finding something new?
Or not does really. It just happen? No, it doesn't work. For me, it's just what excites me. I mean, at the moment, I've been going to Brazil a lot recently, and, you know, from like, I don't know, probably when I first started playing Brazilian music, it was probably more around the sort of late 60s, Marcos Valle, sort of Milton Nascimento type of zone. Then it kind of went a little bit more tropicalio, a little bit psychedelic with people like Gilberto Gil and Caetano Veloso and all that sort of stuff. But recently for me, I've been playing, whenever I go to Brazil, it's that there's this cross between heavy northeastern sort of percussive music with a little bit of psychedelia in there, slightly twisted. If you can find those pieces, you know, they're incredible. And they just, you know, so there's always something somewhere that's going to just take it to another level. And it's just about sort of following your nose. I mean, I can't believe how these people keep unearthing tracks. You think, you know, I've been buying records for years and years, and I'm thinking I must have it all. I'm just touching at 5% of the surface. There's so much stuff underneath that we don't know, and we're just constantly discovering. Other people are discovering for us.
It's Time Team with Giles Peterson. It is. It's a bit of record archaeology that's going on.
Yeah,
right? Well, let's take our next track. This is from Kamasi Washington. This is it's a very handsome sort of triple CD
incredible
set that came out last year. Tell us a bit about this.
Yeah, this is, well, first of all, I think Flying Lotus deserves a lot of credit for what he's done in the sort of LA region, California region, with his record label Brain Feeder and his sort of mentorship for a whole generation of electronic beat producers. He's kind of made LA cool when actually New York was very much at the forefront for years. And in the last sort of probably 5-10 years, it's all about LA, and it's all about Brain Feeder, it's all about, you know, Stone's Throw, Now Again Records. And what Flying Lotus does brilliantly is, he, apart from just sort of mentoring all these new people, he's also a great spokesperson, and he's managed to bring through people like Thundercat, who's obviously now working with the likes of Kendrick Lamar and Erykah Badu and all those sort of people. And he's also, being the great nephew of Alice Coltrane, so she was his aunt, so she was his great aunt. And
now, there's some good tropical outfits.
Yeah, but and again, deep heritage for him. You know, he's like sort of second generation to John Coltrane. So his touch on jazz has always been really important for him and what he does for jazz music. So we were all waiting for him to sign a jazz musician. And he went and found Kamasi Washington, and he gave him a platform, gave him the artwork and the idea, and allowed him the freedom to go and make an incredible jazz record in an acoustic setting, done over a period of, a few weeks. They just locked into a studio in LA, spent the money, got the strings in, got some incredible musicians in there, and let the guy free to make an incredible spiritual jazz record for 2015 for a new generation. And because, of course, of the following that Brain Feeder has, it's opened up the door for all these younger kids who've just discovered, you know, who are discovering jazz for the first time. So basically, you know, in a traditional, more acoustic sense. So that's really what Flying Lotus has done. He's found an incredible artist, done beautiful artwork, and made an incredible record over three or four vinyls. And it sounds like this. It is an epic album, Kamasi Washington.
What beauty and energy. That's Rerun Home, Kamasi Washington. The enthusiasm you have for this stuff is just palpable. I mean, what a wonderful introduction to a record. I go, so what's this one about? And I feel I know everything. I feel like I've been to that studio about spending the money and getting the strings in. That's a real work of art.
The bad news for us is that he was meant to be playing at the Worldwide Awards on next Saturday, but he broke his leg when he was on tour recently in Norway. And he can't travel out of America now. So he was a special guest. He can't come over, unfortunately. But
Will you be doing the satellite link up?
He's going to definitely.
From Ward 3.
I think he might well have won Album of the Year. We'll see. But, right. We'll see, because that record did go down exceptionally well. I mean, fortunately for us all in London, we managed to see him at the London Jazz Festival. We played at the Barbican, and it was an incredible night. In fact, Boiler Room, I think. Broadcast it, which is quite wild, really, that you suddenly get Boiler Room broadcasting a jazz concert at the Barbican in London of Kamasi Washington. That's where we've come to, which is great. And that's actually, you can watch it again. It's an amazing concert.
And what do you think about that? I mean, about the kind of return of radio. You started on Pirate Radio, and it's kind of come back with all the online stuff. I mean, that's us here at Monocle 24 for a start. And I guess it's how a lot of your international listeners listen to your Radio 6, your BBC 6.
It's been brilliant.
Show. I mean, that's such a place to discover this stuff as well.
It is good. I mean, I think that, you know, in a way it loses the focus in one way. So there's more of us doing radio. And so maybe, no one has particularly high audience. It's lots of small audiences, you know, who can just find their person, their place. But what there wasn't back in the day is there. What, you know, if you want to hear a whole night of Albert Ayler, you can find someone on the web that will give you that. You couldn't get that before. So that's the great advantage of, you know, if you really know what you want and you're searching for, there's a far better chance of finding it. And there are some great radio stations that are giving some great, you know, not just playing records, but, you know, good discussions and debates. And it's very important, I think.
Well, we're going to head to California, to Oxnard, home almost of one of our favourite radio stations as well, KCRW, out there in Los Angeles. This is Anderson .Paak. Maybe we'll take a little bit of this and then Charles Peterson can talk to us. Spells are on the clock, pants are on the globe, disco 54, I stare you in the eyes, spin you on your toes. Music and music without song. Filling the top rows, shot through blindfolds, pass the nitro, rock the love boat, get high and get low, kill the Merlot, step in your fast boat, you pick up your gold gold. Make love once or more, we rest and encore. Doodle that, 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 hey. Break you off and you kick that cat, hey. Never seen no one this gorgeous. Pay your whole damn mortgage. But when you look at the time, hey, still you the one on the mind, hey. Still you the topic, the prime, hey. Thank God that it's Friday, tonight let's be the life of the party. There's nothing to me, get up and move your feet.
I never wanna waste your time. My life. So precious.
That was a little bit of Am I Wrong, upcoming from Anderson .Paak. So his first record was called Venice. Second one's going to be called Malibu.
Yes.
Guess where he's from? That's some slinky stuff, isn't it?
Yeah,
cross swords with Anderson .Paak?
Well, I just love, I've always had a strong connection with soul and disco and boogie and hip hop in a way. And I think one of the great things that's happened in the last couple of years is someone like Kendrick Lamar, who's coming out of the hip hop scene, but is pushing it out and trying different things and mixing different rhythms and become a huge international star. And I'd rather have someone like him as a huge international star than say, I don't know. I mean, I don't really want to say Kanye, because I think Kanye's great musically. But I think that, you know, it's great to see really brilliant musicians with great ideas doing really well and not just being underground. And I think that's one of the great things about To Pimp a Butterfly, which was Kendrick Lamar's album. And I think that and people like Flying Lotus, which we were talking about earlier on, they've been able to encourage new artists to feel they don't have to go down the commercial or the mainstream route. Now, that sounds quite commercial, this track by Anderson .Paak, but if you listen to American radio, that's actually slightly off.
Yeah.
You know, it's still slightly offbeat, and he's trying stuff out. Now, Anderson .Paak, he's I think late 20s. He's a drummer. He was all over the Dre album that came out last year. So, you know, he's pretty used to the sort of mainstream stuff. But he's got incredible songwriting ability. He's got great live talent. And he reminds me of Bobby Womack, like a cross between a really, like, I don't know, like Q-Tip and Bobby Womack. In a way, it's a kind of combination of sort of hip-hop and soul together. And he's a live performer and he represents LA in a big way. And he's the most exciting thing that I've heard in the last few months in that territory of music. So I'm delighted that he's coming over. He's coming over with his quartet, actually.
So he's playing your awards.
Yeah, he's playing and his first show ever in the UK. And that, in a way, the whole thing about the awards as well for me is that on one hand, it is people that have done really well and that people know and recognise. But also it's about bringing in new people. I mean, you know, we had the first concerts from James Blake back in the day. I mean, Lauren Vuller, loads of people, you know, they come through the awards. I mean, I remember the first time James Blake played there, people were chatting throughout his whole set because, you know, it was like, it was too slow, you know.
Yeah, right.
But now you can do anything.
Yeah.
But, you know, so in a way for me and for the awards, there's a bit of it that is also about introducing the kind of artists that in a year's time will be household names.
Well, it's amazing stuff. Thank you for sharing those three tracks. I mean, that's a hot ticket. It's, what is it, the 16th of January at London's Coco.
Yeah.
Giles Peterson, a man who obviously goes home after all this and listens to Chris Rea.
Absolutely. Give it to me.
Thank you so much for coming in. It's great to hear your take on all this stuff and for filling us in on your feelings about radio and the way the whole industry is going as well.
Great.
Thank you very much, Giles Peterson.
You. That was Rob speaking to Giles Peterson a little bit earlier. And you're listening to the Monocle Weekly.
Time for some new music now, and let's pick up where Giles Peterson left off. You heard a brief snippet of this a little earlier. This is California's Anderson .Paak with Am I Wrong? Voilà. Voilà. Yeah. I'm only coming out to play. Nothing more that I hate in this life. The wrong impression, I only have one to make. You can open your palm, waiting to catch a break. The cards are far where they may. And what about me? I believe in fate. Huh. They wanna know where I'll be in 5. Huh. But what about today? What about tonight? Only one at a time. So precious. It's yours, it's mine. Only one at a time. My life, my life, yeah. Am I wrong to assume if she can't dance, then she can't ooh, yeah. Am I wrong to say if she can't dance, then she can't ooh? Hey, I never wanna waste your time. My life, so precious, is yours. It's mine, and look at the time. My God, so precious. It's yours, it's mine. Only one at a time. So precious.
That's Anderson .Paak there with Am I Wrong? You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. Heffin Jones is a visiting tutor in design at Goldsmiths College and a designer in residence at the London Design Museum. It's the latter appointment that's caught our eye here at Monocle, as Heffin has been highlighting the design and traditional craft of his homeland, Wales.
His show at the museum, Cosmic Colliery, demonstrates how old Welsh collieries could be transformed into sites for underwater astronaut training. And it follows Heffin's earlier work, the Welsh Space Campaign, which looked at how Welsh design could potentially go as far as to help a man into space. A very distinctly dressed one. For that project, Heffin commandeered the talents of a Welsh plumber to build a pressure system for a potential spacesuit, hired a traditional clog maker to make space boots, and even asked some of the last remaining wool mills in Wales to provide material for that suit. And Heffin joins us now to talk more about Cosmic Colliery and other things. Welcome to the programme.
Thank you for having me. Hello.
Well, it's nice to have you here. As Andrew said, when you walked in, you could at least have been wearing some nice woolen space boots.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of one of the things, isn't it? You're kind of showcasing traditional Welsh industries and saying how they could be transformed and future-proofed, I suppose.
Of course. I think the boots would be better suited if I was to be wearing them in space, I think right now I'm happy with my Doc Martens.
Yeah. I mean, you're wearing a boot, but it's not.
It's not spacey. Spacey. Okay. But yeah, coming to the future-proofing aspect of it, I think that's a good way to put it, rather than being a kind of retrospective, you know, looking through the past through rose-tinted lenses. This is actually trying to say, you know, these industries came, they went. Here's a kind of potential new application for them. How does that make you feel? What kind of tensions are brought up as people can be producing these new objects that potentially connect them to somewhere really far away, probably the furthest they can get from where they are right now?
Yeah.
And tell us, obviously, we've given you a bit of a light-hearted introduction. Is this a humorous take on craft and industry in Wales, or are you using humour to actually kind of touch some quite serious points, as Rob was saying about, you know, future-proofing Wales is changing industrial landscape, for example?
Yeah, I think humour is also an easy kind of way to get people engaged in something. It's always a way which it takes a really serious thing and you can introduce it in a quite accessible way. But yeah, with this project, it does have elements of humour to it, but I've always kind of taken it very, very seriously in my kind of engagements with the people. So,
but when you go and knock on the door of, you know, someone who's a plumber and say, "Will you make me something for, you know, a space for space exploration?" Have these people kind of got it at first glance, or have some of them thought, "Oh my God, who's this kind of design joker who's coming knocking on our door?"
I've had a lot of meetings with people which have gone terribly. But
this isn't one of them, by the way.
Yeah, and it's been balanced by, I guess, those really good ones. But it's always hard, of course. You know, you're going up to someone and you're saying, "Okay, manager of the National Wool Museum, here's an image of a woolen spacesuit. Can you work with me to kind of figure out how to do this?" And it's kind of snowballed. That's how it's kind of became successful in many ways. So I'd arranged a meeting to the manager of the National Wool Museum, and then from there I had the initial idea that, you know, they could give me all the fabric, and they said no, let's work with many people. So then we mapped out the last kind of working wool mills. I started calling, visiting different places, and I think once you get someone who's quite pivotal, and this is important in other projects, Cosmic Colliery as well, you need to get someone who's kind of at the heart of community. Once you've kind of got someone like that involved, then other people around them will be more likely to kind of engage, will more likely to become part of a movement or a kind of an idea.
And you've chosen space to sort of showcase Welsh design talent and the making of things and all the rest of it. That's an interesting thing, because you're kind of, it seems to me like you're setting off from the standpoint that heritage is a bit boring, but let's drag these industries into the 21st century. Space is a strange one as well, because that's kind of got a retro feel to it somehow.
Yeah.
Despite the fact it's the final frontier, it all seems a bit 60s.
Yeah.
A bit Stanley Kubrick. But is that kind of part and parcel? So this is an industry, the space industry is something that needs things to be made for it. This isn't about an online world. This is actually about a physical world, and that world is space.
Yeah, I think that the space thing, I mean, it's space is awesome. It's just cool. But the main thing for me was that space, looking at it from more of a social perspective. So, you know, it's the furthest we can get from our kind of domestically bound setting. It's the furthest you can get away from a plumber. And if you can work together with someone to make something that connects them to that place, then that's really exciting for me. That's really amazing what kind of feelings are generated during that process. And then the heritage thing as well, you know, I'm generally a bit annoyed at that. You know, sometimes I think that if we keep going on this way in Wales, the whole of Wales will become this kind of National Museum Heritage Park where we kind of look retrospectively at everything. But I really want heritage to be seen as this kind of active process. So we're not spectators of heritage, we're kind of active participators in it. And we can kind of move it into something that can, you know, can do something for us.
So explain to us, if we kind of rock up to see Cosmic Colliery, what will we actually see then?
In the exhibition at the moment?
Yeah.
So as part of that work, rather than the space campaign, I produced a film for this project. So this is a kind of a short film which I was working with a community to imagine how the abandoned coal mine could become an astronaut training centre. So there's that, and then there's other artefacts as well, which kind of build around the film. So there was the property developer, Paul.
He's great. So he was a DJ. He's an acid house.
So he's the guy who owns the coal mine.
Right.
And he used to be an acid house DJ in the 80s in London. And luckily for me, he's
and now he owns a coal
fascinated.
Mine.
And now he owns a coal mine from Crystal Palace down to South Wales in Ystrad Manach. Now he owns a coal mine. And yeah, he was really engaged in the project, which was lucky for me. I could have easily had someone who, quickly swept me to the side. But he was really involved in it. He performed a set inside the colliery building, brought his old white labels, played an acid house set whilst reading his favourite book, Stephen Hawking's Brief History of Time. The reason I was doing that, coming back to, it's using the Astronaut Training Centre, it's using that as a kind of vehicle to get people to think big about an old industry. And with Paul as well, his plans were to turn it into flats. And so him performing a kind of public thing, he started to think about it as, this could potentially become a kind of acid house festival venue. And then these outer buildings could become kind of music residency spaces. So it's about doing kind of short acts or kind of interventions that get people to reimagine more public uses, I guess, for those kind of spaces.
And this is your role. I mean, you're a tutor as well at Goldsmiths,
yes.
Right? I mean, so do the people that you talk to and that you tutor, is this how you do your teaching and your mentoring of people to kind of take something that might sound odd or might sound highfalutin or might sound like a piece of potential fiction and kind of imagine how you might make it fact? It's the kind of intellectual side of design.
Yeah, I think, you have to be naive. I think that's something I try and encourage.
Re-embracing your childhood.
Yeah, become an idiot in some ways. That's something that I really encourage students to be at the start of the process, because it allows you to ask the questions no one else can. Being an idiot allows you to kind of challenge conventions. But then it's about taking that silly thing that's emerged from being an idiot, whether it's a question like, can a plumber build a spacesuit? Or can an abandoned coal mine become a national training centre? And then it's about taking, that through a really rigorous process and working with people and working with their kind of resources around there to try and move that into some kind of reality, to some kind of resolution.
And tell me, what was your initial link with space? Because, you could have set off imagining all sorts of things, and with the other space projects, is there something that's always gripped you about the world of space? Does that, as Rob said, does it feel like the frontier of design or of engineering in some way?
Yeah, I think I had as much of an interest in space as anyone else. Not anymore. So, but it's mainly just...
He's watched Star Trek, Andrew.
Yeah.
the reboot.
I did see Star Wars recently, but yeah, the space thing, it's mainly from the kind of social perspective for me. It's really that idea that you can move someone from where they are, what kind of expectations they have about what they make or what kind of aspirations they have, and through making something that can exist or could exist in space, what kind of feelings that could generate, or what kind of how that kind of challenges the contingency of their everyday.
Is it, the other thing I wanted to question you about is what was interesting. Just this week, we saw that Ai Weiwei is going to go to Lesbos and set up an art studio on the island to kind of document what's happening with migration there. And I kind of wondered when I heard that, I wondered what people's reaction would be when they kind of finally made it alive to Lesbos and met Ai Weiwei. And for you, when you're talking to communities that were devastated by the closure of collieries, by the failure of the mine industry, with what happened during the miners' strike, were there some people you came across who felt, hold on, are you having a bit of a joke at our expense?
Yeah, I think it's always been important from a kind of an ethical standpoint that you introduce the project for what it is. I always said, this isn't something I'm going to make happen. If this is going to happen, it's going to happen as a result of you coming together to kind of achieve it. I think that happened when I met with the MP for the area, the local MP. I won't say his name, but it's, you can work it out, I guess, if you know where the project takes place. But, so I met up with the MP for the area. I sent him before a list of kind of people I was working with, schools, local historians, groups. Within 2 minutes, he kind of stood up of a half an hour meeting I kind of arranged with him. Within 2 minutes, he stood up and left the room. saying, you know, I haven't got time for your crackpot ideas. So, but then that's balanced by leaving there and then going to get a train and in the kind of tuck shop by the train, buying a Mars bar. And then I had a 10-minute chat with a guy I bought the Mars bar from about his desires to go to Mars. So that kind of little moments like that keep the project going.
I like this little part of Wales. It sounds amazing. I want to go there on my holiday. It sounds like you meet a finer class of man and woman down in this area.
Definitely interesting characters to be had all around there.
And just let us know, is this, I mean, you know, this is a fantastic sort of esoteric idea. And I know it is an esoteric idea. I know it has its roots in practicality and in rebirth and all the rest of it. But is this your day job, so to speak? Or are you using the tools that you do in your day job to do these side projects?
Yeah, this is my job. It's weird when my brother who worked on the spacesuit building, the plumber pressure system. So my brother's a heating engineer and plumber. You know, going back over Christmas, and he's like, what are you doing? Yeah, you know, he's working, doing what he's doing. What are you doing? And I explain what I'm doing. Him getting his head around that is quite funny. So he's like, you live in London and you do projects about people building spacesuits. And yeah, and then, okay. And it's finally made sense, but he's on board with it. But yeah, so I teach a bit, but mainly this is it. Yeah. And the next projects will hopefully see me. Well, I'm planning to move away from Wales and space.
Oh, so you're off to Cape Canaveral or something next?
Yeah, but as a territory, but still keeping this idea of kind of collaborating with people as a means to kind of think big, as a way, you know, using what skills they have, but kind of, you know, applying it differently as a way to kind of get them to dream or get them to kind of think bigger.
Nice. Well, Heaven Jones, thank you very much for talking us through it. Cosmic Colliery is on at the Design Museum, right?
That's right, until March.
Beautiful. Get Fantastic. Down there and harness your inner spaceman.
The London Short Film Festival is in full swing this weekend and will be hitting local cinemas across the city for the next week too. Among the shorts on show are enlightening talks, including a look behind the fairly mysterious casting process of large films and also small ones, and a special event celebrating the career of the filmmaker Harmony Korine.
There'll be 450 films shown throughout the week, and joining us now to tell us more about the power of short films is the festival's artistic director, Philip Ilson. Philip, welcome to the programme.
Hello.
And first of all, in this kind of sort of recent proliferation of kind of online film hubs, Netflix and Amazon and these sorts of things, does this make the job of the festival easier or tougher, I wonder?
It's a good question, actually, because a few years ago everyone thought that cinema was over and people would just watch everything online or not go to the cinema. But I think the last few years has been a massive resurgence in cinema audiences anyway. I mean, last year a few new cinemas opened in London, and that's continuing kind of into this year, really. So yeah, with short film, which do obviously have an online life, I think people still want to see them on the big screen in front of an audience.
And that, sorry, Andrew, and that audience presumably is very important for this. You get a festival audience is something that an audience that's in the know, that applaud films that don't in the multiplex, they don't even at some of the august venues that you have the short film festival at. So it's presumably about creating an atmosphere.
Yeah, definitely. It's about having a public. I mean, the film festival is something that's kind of very traditional in the sense that a film festival, you know, have existed for as long as cinema, but that's not going to go away. That sort of public interaction isn't really going to change despite the changes in technology and the way we live.
And tell me, 450 films, a fascinating thing. What's the intent behind most of the people making these films? Are they feeling that these are their calling cards to one day make features? Are they hoping to get into TV? Are these one-off projects, or are these projects that just really go around the festival circuit? What's the kind of, when you meet these filmmakers, what's their ambitions?
I mean, you kind of answered the question. I think that a lot of people make films for different reasons. Obviously, there are the calling card films, and there's a lot of people out there that have studied film school that they want to move into making features or move to TV. The festival shows lots of different styles of stuff. I mean, we have quite a big documentary program. We're showing lots more sort of viral stuff that would be made more for online. Or, yeah, it's just an experimental work as well that may be more suited to a gallery. So I think there's sort of lots of different reasons, personal reasons for why people make
film. Is there a competitive element for you running a festival like this? Because, you know, I guess if there are a lot of these documentary filmmakers and there's a set of people who go around, you need to have a reasonable amount, I hope, of premieres and things which are, you know, starting their life with you. What's the kind of news line that you try and get? Do you try to say to people, can you hold off and let me have your film first?
No, we're not. We don't have any. I think the thing with short film is that there are very few places to show them anyway in the cinema. So we don't have any of those premiere places in premiere things in place. And a lot of festivals as well are kind of doing a similar thing with short films. It's different with features if you're premiere in the new, I don't know, whatever, Tarantino or whatever. But I think with shorts, it's just getting them up on the big screen. So we don't mind if a film's already out there online or even if it's had other screenings. I think it's more creating an atmosphere for the festival.
I've got a double-pronged question. Are you okay with that?
You go for it.
Guests and co-host.
Okay.
One, how long is a short film, actually? Well, is there a sort of stipulation, like a feature has to be 90 minutes? Or?
Yeah, no, I mean, again, it's nothing set in stone. I mean, we do a 45-minute limit for entries because, obviously, we have an open submission process. But, you know, very few short films are 45 minutes. We are showing a couple of slightly longer ones that are pushing that length. But and documentaries tend to be sort of half an hour, 35 minutes. But I'd say that sort of 80% of the work that we show is between sort of 6 and sort of 20 minutes, really. So that's kind of the time that people think of when they're thinking of short drama or, yeah.
Yeah, because it's an interesting thing, actually. You mentioned a lot of documentaries are half hour.
Yeah.
There is this automatic thing, that switch that goes off in your head where you think, ah, like a TV documentary, like maybe a commercial TV documentary or something.
Yeah.
And is there something sort of similar to Andrew's question, actually, that makes a short film documentary different to something that might crop up on BBC Two here in the UK, for example? Is there something filmic and un-TV about something that you'd show?
Yeah, again, there's no rules. I think some of the stuff we show would end up on TV if it's documentary sort of related, or it would be made for more of an online audience. But yeah, I don't think, you know,
there's not a sort of element that makes it short filmic rather than
documentary. No. Yeah. I mean, there are different styles of documentary. It could be more of a creative documentary where it's more of a visual documentary, or it could be something that's a bit more sort of information, talking heads, you know, to camera type thing. But we show all sorts of work, really.
And give us one or two highlights from the festival that you are the films that you've seen that you think we should particularly look out for.
I suppose it's difficult to give highlights out of 450 films
because you'd upset about 440 odd other people.
I've got one that I definitely want you to talk about.
Okay,
I've got the website up here because I never stop researching, as you know. This is on London Short Film Festival. What to look out for? Cats and Cats and Cats and Cats. The best in classic and contemporary cat cinema.
Yes,
includes Stealing Sheep live score.
This is our big showcase event. The festival.
Were you going to say that anyway?
I was going to flag that one up. Okay. Basically, the festival isn't just about screening short films that are submitted to the festival. Just on that front, we get about 2,000 submissions and select a number for screening in the cinema. But the festival has also got sort of special events, and the Cats and Cats and Cats program event is a big live event that takes place at the Round Chapel up in Lower Clapton. Which is an amazing venue that's just started to be used for live events. But basically, we wanted to reclaim the cat video. So we've sort of did a bit of research into kind of experimental cat films from the 40s and 50s.
This is after online ubiquity.
Yeah, we are succumbing and actually starting the night off with some YouTube cat videos, which we're doing in conjunction with a short film festival in Vienna who have been collecting cat videos for years. But then we're also presenting it as a more artistic night. We've commissioned three cat films by known sort of artist filmmakers. Vivian Dick, who was working in the late 70s, early 80s in New York with artists like Lydia Lunch and Sonic Youth. She's like a film tutor in Ireland now, so she's made a cat video for us. And Nicholas Abrahams, who'd worked with Jeremy Deller in the 90s, made a lot of videos for bands like Stereolab. He's made a cat video for us as well. So yeah, it's kind of like a cat film. I'm not going to say cat video because that makes it sound a bit cheap.
An avant
Yeah, the films we researched, the cat film, kind of interesting. It was like artists like Maya Deren, who were working in the 40s, and Stan Brakhage, who was working in the 50s, you know, in artists, filmmakers. And it was surprising how many people are making films with cats in back in that time.
Okay,
Stealing Sheep are doing a live score to some of them, basically.
This is good news as well.
Yeah. Anything else? You were about to tell me one other film that I think you'd got a tip for greatness. Is there something else that you think that we should look out for?
Yeah, for our opening night, we have a number of shorts that we've nominated for the Best Award, and they're the kind of highlight of what we think is the best in the festival. So it's filmmakers that might go on. We've had sort of BAFTA winners in that kind of opening night programme in previous years, so... Yeah, that's kind of the best films of the festival out of the 400, which I know is like eight films. But...
Well, we got the cat in, and we got the cat in. It's
yeah.
all right. It's good. Okay. It's good stuff. And just to go back to my first question, actually, about this sort of creation of an atmosphere, which is part of, presumably the job of a festival. What is the atmosphere of that? Is it kind of getting? Is your great joy listening to people talking as they walk out of the auditorium? Sort of
thing? Yeah, I mean, I think for any festival and any festival that I've been to, it's important to be in the bar. After the screening where you meet other filmmakers and other like-minded people, and I'm a big fan of going to festivals throughout the year. I tend to, you know, head over to Hamburg, there's a good one, and trying to get to Berlin this year, you know, because I think it's that atmosphere of everyone meeting and everyone talking about film and what they've seen. And it's great with short filmmakers because they really want to get out there and they really want to get their face shown and they want to meet other industry people. So I think, you know, that side of it is equally as important as sort of sitting in the darkened room.
Well, it all comes down to I'll see you in the bar.
Yeah.
Thank power to it.
Yeah.
Philip Ilson, Artistic Director of the London Short Film Festival. Thank you very much. And there we have it, Andrew. Edition 340 of the Monocle Weekly.
That's a lot of editions, isn't it? 340.
God. No wonder. Do you remember the top of the show when Tom Edwards walked in and said, "You both look..." and then left a sort of rather dramatic pregnant pause.
Yes, it's like one of those things where there's like... dotted words and you fill in the relevant adjective.
Yeah, you look like a couple of people that have presented 340 editions of a programme and showing it. I don't think he meant that at all.
No. I think we're back and we're sprightly.
And I think shows like that, I really enjoyed that show. I think shows like that keep us young.
I love, I don't love him, but I love Heaven's Idea. The Welsh colliery, spacesuit, extravaganza. He's good.
Yeah, exactly. Fill up a colliery with water, and I certainly won't go in it and pretend to be an astronaut. It sounds terrifying, but power to you. And Giles Peterson, legend, great having him in. And I think we should work trip up to Coco to celebrate his dudes. Shall we thank our pals behind the glass?
You do it.
I sounded like... Come on.
No, okay.
You don't get paid by the word.
Okay,
like
no,
I do.
Okay.
Today's show was produced by Tom Hall, and our studio manager was...
Toby Hammond.
The Monocle Weekly, we're back at the same time, same place next week. For the time being, from me, Robert Bound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.